Have you ever had any snafus as a result of bringing the show into the business, even though that's the whole point of it?
No, I don't.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Suzanne Summers. That was bad. We filmed the sale of her house, and they wanted to negotiate my commission down, and they wanted that on camera because I guess her husband, Alan Hamill, wanted to look like a great negotiator. And I said, Alan, don't do that. It's not going to look good. Suzanne is just like a beloved character, and you're going to look like a cheap asshole. And they didn't listen to me. And the show aired, and they looked like idiots. And they called me, and they were very upset. And I said, guys, I told you not to do this. So, well, then she died.
Welcome to Driving Wealth with Justin Demko. In Driving Wealth, we seek to uncover the mindset of successful individuals in sports, entertainment, and business. What has driven their ambitions? What kept them in the game despite obstacles and setbacks? What were the key decision points along their journey? And what advice do they have for the next generation coming up in their field? This is Driving Wealth.
In this episode, we sit down with Josh Flagg, who is one of the top real estate agents in the world, with over $3 billion in sales, author of three books, and star of Million Dollar Listing Los Angeles. What does it take to sell a $120 million home? How does his TV show impact his real estate business? And what are smart strategies for you to use when buying or selling your next home? Ladies and gentlemen, the one and only Joshua Daniel Flagg. I had to wait to do this interview with you because you're spending a ton of time in New York City.
Yeah, I'm going back and forth.
And you're staying over at the Carlisle, I believe.
Yeah.
It's a great spot.
It's the best.
And tell us, what brought you to New York? Obviously, you've been there a number of times as a tourist. But then when did you start getting serious about doing New York? Well, and when did you start doing deals there?
Well, so I'm only brokering in Los Angeles, but now I'm developing in New York. So we have some stuff downtown. We're selling some stuff. We're buying. We just went into contract on something on the Upper East Side, a building on Lexington. We're going to develop that out.
And this is in the commercial space?
Yeah, just right near Bloomingdale's.
So as an experienced residential real estate agent, is it interesting for you to be on the other side of that when you go to New York and you, I'm assuming, work with a commercial agent to take you around?
Yeah, but or you find things off market and you go directly to the sellers. That's really what you do.
That sounds a little bit like more like your style.
Yeah. So we just go directly to the principals. In this case, this is a family that had owned this property for, I don't know, since the Carter administration. I don't know. They owned it forever. We just took them an offer that they couldn't refuse. And then we bought the building next door to it also.
And you've had some transactions already aside from buys? Have you bought and sold?
Yeah, we own something downtown, which we just got an offer on. And we just brought it to the market yesterday. It's on Mercer Street, which is probably one of the best streets in Soho. It's got all the top stores on that street. You've got Prada, you've got the Ferrari dealership, you've got the Mercer Hotel, you've got Alaya. All the great stores is right there in the middle. So we bought two spaces and broke through a wall and made a huge space. And we leased it out to a store for 10 years. And then got two offers already on it. But we brought it to the market so that we can see if we can even do better.
When you guys are doing these deals, especially on the sale, a lot of my clients are looking at these 1031 exchanges.
Yeah.
How familiar are you with that process and have you guys been utilizing it?
Always. 1031s are it's essential. I think that when they talked about getting rid of them, that would have been devastating. I mean, it's just sometimes they still talk about doing that, but that would be devastating. I mean, it's really important.
And for our clients, explain what the benefit of the 1031 is.
You're deferring the tax, and you can defer it until you're dead, essentially. So let your kids worry about it. And then, you know, obviously you have, I don't know, what is the estate exemption? $13 million a person?
Correct.
So $26 million is exempt already. So everything above the $26 million is what you're paying the tax on. But by at that point, if you have proper estate planning, you shouldn't have any tax when you die.
right? There's a great hat that I bought for clients over the years. It says buy, borrow, die.
Yeah, that's great. I like that. Yeah.
And so do you think New York is going to be a continued venture for you on this front?
I love New York.
Like a lifelong.
Yeah, I love it. I go back and forth every time. I was there. I got into town today. I'll be here for a week and then I'll go back to New York for a week. And then I'll come back here for a week. I'll go back for a week. It's great. So I just do all my residential brokering here and then I do developing in New York. So two totally different things.
You're known as a very hands-on agent where even in your book, you talk about the importance of being at showings, being available to clients. How are you going to handle the back and forth, especially when you've got a very full deck of a lot of listings for sale?
Well, I can't be at 20 places at once, so I don't take more than 10 listings at a time. But my listings don't sit on the market for a long time, generally because I price them accurately. We time them for my travel schedule. So, you know, we'll launch them when I'm in town, we'll field the offers. And then during the escrow period and negotiations, I don't need to be, that's all on the phone and that's all texting and emailing. There's not really much activity at the property. Then I'll go back to New York.
In reading your book and knowing how you operate, we've known each other for a long time. You spend a lot of time in what I might call the pregame of the business, so that when you sit down with the client, you spend a lot of time figuring out the client's personality, their desires, their issues. And what I liked about in the book towards the end, you talk about how sometimes with a client's specific needs, that will translate into benefits for the buyer. For example, if a seller or a buyer has a certain longer time period, sometimes that actually, while it could be a negative in a negotiation, ends up being a positive because you can identify if the, let's say in this case, a seller's agent is telling you that they're going to need a little bit more time to get out of there, but your buyer also doesn't want to get in there for a certain amount of time. You talk about how you can bring those two things together. So I'm getting into a long question here, but the pregame, I think, is something where when I've dealt with agents, there hasn't been enough of the pregame. The agent hasn't sat down with me long enough to figure out what's going on with me specifically. And so I'm wondering if you got that from experience of dealing with now probably hundreds or thousands of people in the course of your career. Is that something that was innate to you, or was that a skill that you think you had to hone over a long period of time?
I think what I'm really good at is listening to the client. So like when they interview me for a listing, I actually generally ask the client after they've picked me as their broker, why did you pick me? And generally it's because I listen to what I don't just talk and tell them what I'm going to do and not listen to what their needs are. So I think if you listen to the client and you can adapt to what they need, that's generally why they pick me. I don't know if that answers your question, but I'm very good at adapting to each client.
Yeah. And it seems like taking the time to understand, even if it's a good fit. You talk about that in your book where there's some warning signs, some red flags you get sometimes.
You mean if I don't want to take a client on?
Correct. Which must be very difficult. And a question I had for you, which I think you're going to laugh at, is, and I have this in my business as well, where you might have a, let's call it interesting personality, but at a certain dollar value, for me, it's generally assets under management. For you, it's the size of the listing or the buy capability for the client. Would you say that there's some flexibility in, do some of the red flags start to go away when you start hearing a $30, $50, $75, $100 million number, or not necessarily?
Only if it's overpriced. I can work with anybody at any price range, but if the house is worth $5 million and they think it's worth $10 million, the deal's off the table. I'm not even interested. I'm especially not interested if, for instance, somebody calls me and says, you know, I have this house and it's, you know, I don't want to put it on the open market, but if you can bring me $15 million for it off market, I would sell it. And I'm thinking to myself, well, the house isn't even worth $7 million, so why would I, this is a waste of my time. What I'm not good at is the long game. I don't have patience for it. So like people that, maybe some brokers are good at that, working with somebody for years to land them as a client, that's not my specialty. I can't do that. That's not, maybe I should, but that's just not my forte.
It seems to me that almost everyone thinks their house is worth more than it is.
Yeah, everyone. I think my house is worth more than it is.
Where do you think that psychological phenomenon comes from?
I don't know.
When you can show them the data, you can show them the statistics, And yet they still say, yeah, I understand comps in my neighborhood are this, price per square foot is this.
I think it's denial. I think in the back of the head, they actually, I mean, well, sometimes they really don't believe it. But if somebody gives me actual data, I generally will look at it and be like, okay, so this is really what it's worth. As a seller, I don't generally think, I mean, I think in the back of my head, maybe I can get more than it's worth, but I don't. I don't fall into that category. Most homeowners do. They think that their house is worth more because it's their own home. I don't know why.
It's an interesting psychological phenomenon I've had where, of course, I'm, I guess you would say, tangentially involved in the real estate buys or sells of my clients, usually from a financing standpoint, doing the mortgage and whatnot, and determining what's an appropriate amount of spend if it's somebody buying based on their portfolio, based on their income and whatnot. But I've been trying to get to the bottom of that too, which is, it seems to me the best strategy for the sale of a property would be to actually choose a number that's a little bit lower to get that initial interest.
Depends on the market you're in.
Mm.
Like, you can't really do that in a buyer's market. You can do that in a seller's market, but if you price it to get multiple offers in a shitty market, that could not work out so well in your favor.
So it could hurt you to underprice, yeah, hoping for a bidding war.
Yeah, people sometimes say you can never underprice a property. I don't know if I agree with that. I think you definitely can underprice a property, especially in a shitty market. But in a good market, in a shitty market, if you want to get top dollar, you price it for what it's worth and you get multiple offers. You don't underprice it. You don't overprice it. You just price it for what it's worth. That's the best way to move a property.
What kind of market are we in right now in Los Angeles?
It's hard to say. I don't think anybody can answer that. I'm busier now I don't know. I'm really good at adapting to different markets. I can do well in any kind of a market. So even though I've had my best 2 years, I can't tell you if this is a good market or not. I can just tell you I'm very busy. I think that we are in a... people are buying houses. I mean, yeah, interest rates are not great, but I think people are buying houses. Like, that's... I can only speak from my own experience. Is it what it was in 2017 or 18 or even during the middle of COVID when there was bidding wars? No. But I think sellers are more realistic now than they were, and prices have come down. I think there's deals to be had. I think there's buyers out there. I think this is quite a fun market. I think that it's a buyer's and a seller's market in some ways, depending on how you price your property.
And in Los Angeles, it's funny when I'm talking to people and they might not live here. They say, where do you live? I say, Los Angeles. But to me, Los Angeles is really a collection of neighborhoods, where something happening in Malibu might be very different than something happening in Beverly Hills, Century City, Culver City, wherever it may be, Santa Monica. The big news, of course, in Los Angeles in the last podcast I just did was with a client of mine that lives down in the Palisades. Talk to us about what you're seeing in that specific area, really from, let's call it an investment standpoint. So you've had this incredible neighborhood, family neighborhood that appreciated over the years and very popular. And yet you had, out of 5,000 homes, the majority of those homes burned down. And so now we've got empty lots out there. My client who lives out there has said that there's a lot of construction happening right now and a lot of deals being done with the properties. Do you see that as a neighborhood that's going to come back strong? Is that an opportunity, for example, for my clients that have discretionary capital and are thinking about investing in real estate? What would you tell a prospective client that says, hey, I'm interested in the Palisades from an investment standpoint?
I think you're going to be sitting there with it for a while. I don't know if that's a place I'd park money. I mean, that's a long game. I think this is not coming back in like a year. This is like a 10-year play. You know, you're building an entire community back. Sure, when it comes back, it'll be great. But I think you've got a couple of years before you could start investing in the Palisades. I think there's, if you can make money and, you know, do a deal and 2x your money now and do that a couple times, wait for 3 years and then go in there. Unless you just literally just have so much cash sitting around, you just want to land bank on something. But I don't see a line around the block of people buying in the Palisades right now.
Do you think that's different for the areas of, for example, Carbon Beach that just got annihilated? Do you think that waterfront property is any...
Well, that's different because...
better or worse?
Well, I believe in that a little bit more because there's supply and demand. Like, for instance, there's maybe 100 houses on Carbon Beach.
Yeah.
you've got maybe 100 houses on La Costa Beach. Okay, you've got thousands of houses in the Palisades. So, and they're not making beachfront property again. So I was in escrow to buy one of those properties, one of those burnt down lots. I just couldn't make a deal with this particular seller. And then I ended up buying a house in the Hamptons. I think there's opportunity in Malibu, but you have to be a very patient person because you have to deal with Coastal Commission, and that's a nightmare. Right.
And they're talking about the caissons, and they're talking about the sewer, seawalls.
It could be a very expensive venture.
Is it true that there's a lot of foreign money coming in? There were some headlines that I'm not sure if were accurate or not. I probably saw it on Instagram that talked about Chinese buyers coming in and buying up
these. No, there was one family from New Zealand that bought 13 properties along there. I sold them three of them. That's the only foreign money I know about there. What I was going to do was just buy this property and just hold it as land. And then just, I wasn't going to build it. I was just going to sell it once all the neighboring houses were built up and I just have the last lot and then let somebody come in and buy that. That's something I would, and I've sold, you know, already three or four of those to people that agreed with me. So if I was going to do something, it would be in Malibu. It wouldn't be in the Palisades.
What areas of Los Angeles do you think have the most potential, even if it's multifamily or up-and-coming neighborhoods that are being gentrified that people are willing to take a little bit of a risk on? They're not the Beverly Hills. They're not the nice areas of Santa Monica.
Yeah. I'm probably the wrong person to ask that. I'm being serious just because I they used to say like Silver Lake or things like that, right, or Echo Park, but it was never my market. So I don't really know. All I've ever known was where we're sitting right now.
Yeah.
And it's the same with art. You buy blue chip art. It's always going to be, you can buy things that are popular in the moment and then they're not so popular 10 years later. You're same with watches, same with a lot of things. But if you buy the classic things, like tangible, like you buy a Patek, it's a great investment. You buy, I'm trying to think of a...
I have something for you right here that I printed out from reading your book. Take a look at this.
What is this?
Do you recognize that piece?
Let's see, 48, that... But I know those initials. Is that Jacqueline Bisset Kennedy?
Yeah, that's the tape measure that you so coveted that you were talking about in your book, that you wanted to make a bid for it, and that guy had bought it.
Who bought this?
This guy, this architect, yeah.
Most extravagant buyers of silver monogram. That's funny. $48,000, yeah. I recognize the initials. That's funny.
I was going to ask you about this because I think it ties into your love of nostalgia, which has been a trademark for you over the years, where you describe yourself as a very old soul. And I thought one really great part of the book is where you talked about the mistake people make, where you'll have a buyer come in and they'll see some old details of the house that look kind of funky, like an old staircase, or you described a fireplace with some tile on it, but it was painted in some way that has historical value. And some agents, without that knowledge that you have, get into a piece of property and they say, oh yeah, we can take this out and we can tear down the staircase. And you flip that around and you say, look, this staircase was put in 1932. You know, and it has this particular type of wrought iron and it's to service. I love that part of the book where you talk about taking something that someone less knowledgeable wouldn't know about some of the details of the home. I think that's really cool. In fact, one of the times we got together, I had a wine dinner at my house. And I lived in my former house was a Brentwood home up on Woodburn, Brentwood Circle. And we took a little tour of the house, and this was a 1928 Spanish colonial revival. And this is the first time I knew this about you, before I read the book. And we walked around, and you knew where the tile was from. We went up to my little home office, and you said, this originally was not an office. And I was like, what?
Probably a sun deck.
And you were like, this was a sun deck. This was a patio. Yeah. And they enclosed this. And we went down into the billiard room that just looked like it was part of the original home. You said, this originally wasn't here. This was a back patio. And they enclosed it. So my question for you is, did you start to gain this knowledge only after being a real estate agent?
No, since I was a child.
Since you were a child.
I loved architecture and design. And my great-grandfather had one of the fabulous houses in Los Angeles, one of a Paul Williams estate. And I've just always had an affinity for those kinds of things. I don't know many agents that's also why I'm known for selling older homes. Like if you're looking to buy a house in the hills, a modern steel and glass box, you're not coming to me.
I'm the wrong person. That's where I live in.
Well, Yeah. Are you in the hills? Where are you?
No. Well, I have a glass and steel box and plaster, but I'm in Sherman Oaks.
Yeah. It just depends. People, I'm known for certain kinds of things. That's fine. Other agents have other fortes.
Absolutely. Let's talk about some of the big sales you've done. So I know a real hallmark one was the Holmby Hills estate at $120 million. In doing those kind of deals, that's such a massive number. And of course, you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but what I'm trying to get to is for clients of yours, clients of mine, when you get up into some of these bigger numbers, where does the negotiating room start? So obviously on a $120 million sale at 2.5%, you're looking at a $3 million commission just on your side. On the other side.
Well, at $120 million, generally the commission is going to be lower.
Yes. And that's what I wanted to get to is, when do you start entertaining that negotiation of a lower commission? Or is it just something that is kind of default, like, oh, sure, you get over 50 million and that goes from 2.5 to 2. Or once we go over, right? Like, is there?
Generally the commissions are between 2% and 3% until you get to, I'm say probably, you know, over $75 million.
Oh, wow, that high. Okay.
Yeah. But even at that point, if the seller's smart, they just keep it at 2% because you don't want to disincentivize a buyer's agent either. Because keep in mind, you're not the only $75 million house in town. And when you're talking about that kind of money, you know, an agent can easily persuade you to buy a 2% $75 million house over a 1.5% $75 million house.
One thing I've always wondered about those real big time properties is the pool of people that are capable of spending that kind of money on a home must be really small.
So not as small as you'd think.
So to me, it seems like the relationship between the buyer's agent and the seller's agent is really important because, well, I mean, you corrected me on that saying it's not as small as I would think, but I mean, I know the stats and how much people have just in like liquid assets or net worth. But when you're talking a $75, $100, $200 million piece of property, I mean, there's just not that many people out there that can afford that.
Well, that's more of a question for you. If you're buying a house for $200 million, what should you be worth? I mean, you could afford it if you're worth $1 billion, but is that wise? Probably not.
Yeah, I think it depends on how you finance it and what kind of business situation it is. And there's a lot of factors that go into it. Like you say in your book, you talk about your house should be commensurate with your net worth and don't be afraid to spend a lot of it on a home.
Well, you spend a lot of time in your home, right? You know? For me, it's different. Like a house, that's the business I'm in. So it represents a lot more to me than maybe other people. Houses are my passion. So obviously, I value it differently than maybe other people do.
You've been in this house for how long?
I bought this 1.5 years ago.
This is an interesting question, and I sometimes put this back on myself because I run money and manage money for other people, and then I have my own money that I make decisions on. Were there any times where you've been buying and selling homes for yourself that you found yourself making some of the same classic mistakes? Like we were just talking about, everyone thinks their home is worth more than it is. Did you ever laugh at yourself sometimes when you were either buying a property or selling it? Or
I can't say I have. I think that's any house that I bought, most of them have been on the market and I've still bought them and resold them in very short periods of time with doing very little work, even sometimes, or sometimes not even doing any work and made money on it. I just have an eye for acquired properties that are either a sleeper or it's been on the market for a long time or the seller's distressed. Or the house that we're in now, I bought it for $9 million. It just got appraised for 15. I bought it 1.5 years ago. Didn't go up $6 million naturally or from inflation. I bought it right. I did certain things to it that made it look better. I'm going to add another 1,200 square feet to the house. And so by the time we're done, it'll be probably a $16 or $17 million house.
When you're looking at different properties in real estate, especially the higher end stuff, 5, 10, 20 plus, what are some of the things when you look at a piece of property, say, this is an obvious teardown versus we could gut this, we could remodel this, we could add onto this?
Well, at some point it costs too much to redo it that you might as well start from scratch, and it doesn't make sense. But if the house has architectural integrity like this house, like obviously you can never tear a house like this down because the city would red tag it, meaning they would stop it, like the historical society, you know.
Is that because of the architect?
This is the model house for Truesdale.
Ah.
Yeah. So this is very important. In fact, I've been waiting for a year and a half to get permits to do work. And by the way, what I want to do is I'm not trying to do anything. I'm trying to actually keep it as consistent as I possibly can. I want it to look exactly as it did in the 1960s. The things I want to add, nobody would know that it was brand new. And I'm still having a hard time. And I'm a commissioner in the city. So you'd think I would maybe be able to push this along, but no, I can't.
Sounds like California.
Yeah. There's a lot of times I'll go into a house and I'll sell it to somebody and the client will say, oh my God, we'd tear this down. I'll say, what are you talking about? This is a great house. You can fix this. This could be incredible, but they don't see that. They're like, oh, this house is old. I'm like, well, yeah.
How have things changed from the standpoint of, I know Measure ULA put some extra taxes on homes over, I think they just increased it to 5.2 million now.
But yeah.
Then you get up to bigger numbers and the tax rate increases even more. Have you seen that? I know there was a lot of counter, or there was a lot of opposition to it when that measure or proposition first came on board. Have you seen it have that much of an effect where it's maybe discouraged sellers? It's been a couple of years now. What do you think's been the fallout from that?
I mean, it's been a bummer for a lot of sellers. I personally have not had the experience of clients saying, I just can't sell the house because of the ULA. I mean, yeah, 5% is a lot of money, but if you want to sell your house, I don't think you're going to not sell your house over 5%. If you need to move somewhere, you need to move, sir. If you're getting a divorce, you're getting a divorce. If somebody dies, somebody dies. You know, it's 5% is not a big enough margin to not sell your house. It's just annoying and shitty, if anything. Same with how they changed commission rules from, it's always been seller pays the commissions. It's just more annoying now that you have sellers saying, well, no, I'm not going to pay the commissions. The buyers are going to.
At your level, though, I would assume that in most circumstances, the buyer's agent and the seller's agent are coming in and they already know what the deal is. And you guys have a workaround around that from the very beginning. Or not necessarily.
Like out of 100 deals, I would say 2 deals I've had where the sellers have insisted that the buyer's agent pay it. So it hasn't been that much. It hasn't really affected me that much. I don't think most sellers are doing that. I think some very few strange people are, and I don't think it really benefits them because I think they're being penny wise and pound foolish. But that's an annoyance, and the ULA thing is annoyance. They're both annoyances. They're not killing the market.
Well, especially in light that you said you're having your best 2 years.
Yeah, but look, that's for me. I can't say that's the same for other agents. I don't know. I'm good at adapting to different markets.
In your book, you talk about some of the things that are strategic moves for buyers, for example, and well, of course, and sellers. And you talk about the importance of, in the seller's case, doing the inspection first to understand what possible issues the buyer could come back with. And I only experienced this firsthand in selling one of my homes where I did not do that in the beginning, and the buyers asked for a big credit. What I find interesting about it is that there are a number of different negotiating tools that just make sense from the beginning, but even someone who I would consider myself to be fairly experienced in these matters, if you were, say, in a different profession and you weren't an agent, and you were a wealthy individual coming in and buying a piece of property, and we talked about pricing, what other things during the negotiation period have you learned that would be important for, say, my clients who are listening as wealthy people to understand about the right way to negotiate for a property?
Well, what I find interesting is that nobody does that. I'm one of the only agents I know that does that. I always do an inspection first. And the reason being is that if a buyer comes to buy one of my properties and I give them an inspection report ahead of time, they lose all leverage. They can't come back later and retrade me. The contingency period where they do their inspections, 9 out of 10 times, they jack up the price anyway. They'll say, oh, the water heater's, there's 5 years left on the life. I want $20,000 off. Or the roof looks a little old. By the time you're done, I want $250,000 off the price. It's just a means for a retrade. So you don't have leverage if, as a buyer, if you have all that information ahead of time. So I don't know why other agents don't do that. I've been doing that for years. I've always done a home inspection. That's the best $1,200 you can spend as your seller ahead of time. And they still may do an inspection themselves. They may say they want their own inspector. That's fine. Be my guest. But you're not going to be able to say, I didn't know about XYZ. I want $200,000 off. They may say some like little things and you may give them a credit for here, a little whatever. But I think that's important. The other thing I also do is I do a broker's price opinion. So ahead of time, I'll have 20 brokers come and I'll get their opinions. I'll get a low, a medium, and a high, and I'll get a mean average. 20 people aren't going to be wrong. And I'll go back to the seller and I'll say, look, here's what I think your property is worth. We've discussed this already, but I also did a broker's price opinion. Here's 20 people's opinion. 20 people aren't going to be wrong, but the key is that when you're interviewing agents to sell your property, the brokers are naturally going to tell you a higher price because human nature is they know that you're going to go with whoever gives the highest opinion of price, right? So it really doesn't matter what the three people that you're interviewing them are telling you because it's all bullshit to begin with.
Right.
So what I say is, look, here's the reality. This is what your house is worth. But instead of interviewing me and three other people that are probably going to lie to you, pick whoever agent you like, whether it's me or somebody else, pick who you liked and who you feel good with. Then do a broker's price opinion. And by the way, be present. Why don't you sit in and listen? You can hear the feedback so you don't think I'm just making up a bunch of numbers and putting it down. Let's see what these brokers say. They have no incentive to lie because they know they're not coming in to get the listing. They're only coming in because they want to see the house before it hits the open market. That's it.
That seems like a really smart strategy, especially in regard to what we talked about earlier, which is setting the realistic expectations for what a client is most likely going to get their house sold for.
Those are the two best things that I've done. Other agents don't do it. I don't know why. I don't think I'm the smartest person in the room. I can't say I did that, but I've never met another agent that did that. But it's worked.
It's a sound strategy. It shocks me that more people wouldn't be doing that either.
Yeah, right. Well, maybe they will eventually. But.
So we've got the part about inspection. We got the part about broker's price opinion. Any other interesting, let's call them, tips and tricks that you've come across over the years you recommend that people do for leverage points during negotiation?
I think if you price the property accurately and you have multiple offers, that gives the seller a lot of leverage. So, well, you might think that, oh, I don't have as much room to negotiate. When you overprice a property and you don't have any offers, who cares that you have a small margin to negotiate with? Who cares that you have a larger margin to negotiate with? You don't have any offers. So I think if you price it accurately and you get multiple offers, you have more leverage and you can play those offers against each other. And so I guess between the two things I discussed, which were the broker's price opinion and inspection, I think pricing the property accurately is the best thing that you can do. Not that anybody ever listens to me. I tell them to do that, but they don't listen. As much as I'm preaching this, 9 out of 10 times they don't listen to me. But they usually admit that they were wrong halfway through or down the line when it's time to do a price reduction.
Yeah.
But that point's too late.
What's the craziest bidding war you've seen that you can remember where something was listed, you thought it was going to trade at this, and then it just got out of control?
When I've had like 10 offers on a property.
Wow.
Hasn't been a while. That was a different market.
COVID days when it...
No, it was like 3 or 4 years ago. It was just something about this one particular house. I don't know why.
As you think back to it, you still don't know what it was that you priced at a certain point and then you had 10 people come in?
No, because quite frankly, wow. I thought the house was a piece of shit. I don't know. It was just one of those weird things. And then there's been houses that have been extremely well priced and nobody wanted them. But that's how you get good deals. Sometimes things are sleepers and they fall through the cracks. Like this house was on the market for $17 million.
Wow.
Which was too high at the time. A friend of mine went into escrow to buy it for 13 or 13 and a half. And that deal fell apart and I ended up buying it for 9. So over a course of a year listing, I mean, the seller came on too high. So that was mistake number one. Mistake number two was instead of immediately correcting it and pricing it appropriately, like listing it for maybe $12,995, they chased the market and went from 17 to 15 to 13 to $11,995. Wow. And then by the time I came in, he just called me directly and I said, look, this is what I what I think the house is worth, even though obviously I thought it was worth more, but this is what I'll pay you. And actually, I went into contract for this house for 10, and I did exactly what I'm telling you. You as an owner of a house should do is you should do a home inspection ahead of time. There was no home inspection, and I used that leverage and I said, look, the house is this, the house is that, I'll pay you 9 for it.
Yeah.
And then once you're pregnant, you don't want to get out of the deal as a seller usually. You want to just be done with it. And that's when sellers usually just say, fine, let's just sign off. I want to be done. And so I ended up buying a house that I paid 9 for, and it just appraised for 15.
What is the strategy where you have a client and you've got some, let's call it pretty serious insider information that the client really needs to sell a home for whatever the circumstances are? How do you handle that in terms of you need to get that place sold, but you're trying to get the best price for the client and the house should in theory be worth what it is according to broker's price opinion based on comps, so on and so forth. But they need to get this house sold quickly. Have you been in that kind of situation where you had someone who, unfortunately, from economics standpoint, was very desperate? And so you had on one side the clock of them needing to sell, but then also knowing the fair value of the home?
Well, yeah. But I mean, if they're upfront and tell me that ahead of time, I just tell them, okay, if you want to move this quickly, price it to get multiple offers. You're not leaving any money on the table. Just be smart and just don't overprice it. Those are actually the best clients when they need to sell, because they'll price it accurately and they'll get a fair amount of money for the house instead of somebody who can afford to or thinks that their house is worth more or doesn't have a gun to their head. And then they price it for, you know, 20% above value and then they end up selling it for 10% below value.
I've always been curious when it comes to real estate transactions where a client comes to you and they're actually willing to take a lot less for a home, or you see that there's more opportunity. Is there, as an agent, is there some sort of code or rule or law where, let's say that you think, wow, like they're willing to take this, but the property is worth a lot more. Like I'm going to call my buddy or this investing group. Like, how do you deal with that? Or is that just not a circumstance that comes up?
That never happens, because you never have a client that thinks their house is worth less than it really is, unfortunately. But even if that was the case, I mean, if their house was worth six, or if they thought their house was worth six and I really thought it was worth seven, I'd say,
I'll buy it.
Well, maybe, but I think that they would probably, their antennas would go up. I think they would just say, okay, fine, then price it how you think we should get, you know, sell what you think.
Yeah.
I have bought my own listings before.
Oh, you have?
Yeah. I bought a house on Alta in the flats of Beverly Hills that was listed for seven. I bought that and then I just threw in the commission. And so I got a fair deal on it. Not, I didn't steal it or anything. I got a fair deal. But when you throw in the commission.
When you say you throw in the commission, what does that mean? That you...
Well, I'm not paying tax on the money. So I'd rather not take a commission and pay the tax on it.
Smart.
I'd rather just lower the basis. Also lowers the property taxes too, insignificantly, but it's something. And then that one I sold for $8 million. And then I took that money and I bought a house on the 700 block of Bedford. For that, I scored a great deal on it. I basically paid $8 million for that. And then I resold that for 10 without doing any work to it. So I just have a good eye for value, and I can see what you could, like even this house, like little things like this courtyard here was not like this when I bought the house. It was there, but it would look nothing like that. This is so easy. I know things that I can do that are small things that will really look great and increase value.
Going back to your early days, You've been doing $1 million listing for how long now?
20 years.
20 years. So when you first got that opportunity,
yeah,
was there a particular time you remember where the show's taped, the show gets broadcast, and you're in Beverly Hills, you're somewhere in Los Angeles, and someone's like, hey, Josh Flagg, I know you from TV. Was there a specific time you remember where you're like, oh man, this is pretty crazy. I'm starting to get recognized.
I wish I could say I remember that. I don't, because it's been half of my life.
Right.
Literally. I mean, it's been half of my life. I don't remember that moment, but I mean, it did happen at some point, I guess. I just don't remember.
So you get on the show, and I think the benefits to it are obvious. name recognition, PR, branding. What have been some of the negatives associated with being famous?
I would only say the thing that, and there's no way to prove it. There's not. It's not like a thesis. I can't prove it. But I would assume that there are some people that assume that I'm just a broker for television, and so maybe they didn't call me, or I'm too busy filming or whatever. That could be the only thing. I mean, there's no way I could prove that. I mean, it's not like I know. There's a poll I took of people that didn't call me.
In your book, you talked about that. You said that a client was concerned that either you wouldn't have time for them or that they didn't want to be on TV, which they probably don't realize that when these things are taped, obviously there's clients, I'm assuming, that are okay with it and not okay with that. How does all that work when you have the film crew following you around for the season that they're taping?
I mean, most of my clients aren't on the show, or, you know, never have been. It's only a certain kind of person that wants to be on television, right?
Do they make that request, or do you come to them and say, hey, you know what?
Well, generally my antennas go up if they make that request, because if somebody calls me and says, hey, can we get my house on the show? I'm thinking to myself, are you even a real seller?
Right.
So to answer your question, generally, no, I go to the client. And I generally don't go to most clients. I go to only to a certain kind of a client that I think would be somebody that would be willing to or would want to do it.
And has that ever worked against you? Have you ever had any snafus as a result of bringing the show into the business, even though that's the whole point of it?
No, I don't.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Suzanne Summers. That was bad. We filmed the sale of her house, and they wanted to negotiate my commission down, and they wanted that on camera because I guess her husband, Alan Hamill, wanted to look like a great negotiator. And I said, Alan, don't do that. It's not going to look good. Suzanne is just like a beloved character, and you're going to look like a cheap asshole. And they didn't listen to me. And the show aired, and they looked like idiots. And they called me, and they were very upset. And I said, guys, I told you not to do this. So, well, then she died. So, I mean, what can I say?
Right. Let's get into then, after the 20 years, you are now involved in a number of things. You're staying with the show, right? Where are you guys with this season?
The last season finished already.
Yeah.
So right now we're on pause.
Pause meaning?
Pause is when they determine if they want to come back or not.
Got it. And when do you get a heads up on that? And
they don't tell you. I mean, it's code name for 50-50, whether they keep it or they don't. But keep in mind also, the show has been on longer than Knots Landing. Like no show has been on for 20 years.
Right.
Law and Order.
Yeah, it's incredible.
I've been on that network longer than any other individual, believe it or not. So I would say that, yeah, whatever happens, I'm fine with either way.
And if it weren't to come back, you're known for being people love to watch you on the show, right? You have a great personality. You're fun to watch. So do you see yourself coming back for a different version of that? If that were to be offered to you, would you want to stay in this reality show real estate world, or would you want to do something else?
I don't know if I have time for it, to be quite honest with you. Between the only other show I could film right now would be something which is based on what I'm doing now, which is going back and forth between New York and LA, because I can't have a show that's based only in Los Angeles. I'm physically in two, I can't be, it's impossible. That's like, I have two jobs. I'm a developer in New York and I'm a broker in California.
Right.
So I can't be an East Coast developer and a broker in California and a film television star. That's too much.
When they do this season, how long do they tape for?
9 months.
Oh, it's that long.
Yeah, because keep in mind, this is not like a show where you're just
scripted.
You're following transactions.
Right.
And transactions take time.
Right. And so they need to shoot it over that whole period. Then they go into editing. Then they get the finished product and then figure out where to put it in for the season.
That's more programming, but the transaction, the initial listing meeting, the open houses, the negotiation, the closing times 12 episodes. That's 12, like transactions usually take 30 to 45 days. So even to get all that done in 9 months is a lot.
For your former colleagues that were on the show that are not now, that you're still friends with, do they have any remorse about not being on anymore? Or are they like, oh man, you know what? I'm glad I don't have to deal with that anymore.
I don't think anybody, unless they're full of shit, would say, yeah, I'm too busy for that. Like, you're lying. It's a great marketing tool.
Great publicity, yeah.
Yeah. But it's not like I don't, like, the show hasn't been on this year, so my business has only been up. I don't think that that has anything to do with the show on or off. I just think my business has grown from age 20 to now. It's gone up every single year. It's never, maybe with the exception of like 1 or 2 years in like the depths of a shitty market. But even in those years, it's basically gone like this. So,
and you talked about in your book about taking advantage, almost making lemonade out of lemons. What activities do you do in a 2008, 2009 environment to be smart? Like, don't hide under a rock, get out there, because when the market comes back, you're going to have more contacts. The market's going to come back. And when the market comes back after these recessions, it comes back strong. So you got to be well positioned to take advantage of that.
So what's your question?
Well, I guess there is no question there, rhetorical statement. How about this one? In your book, you talk about the 2008, 2009 environment where sales were down, tough situation for everybody. What do you do, especially for those listening that are newer agents? What did you do during that time? And what would you advise people to do when all sales are slower and there's fewer buyers out there, prices are coming down? What should somebody do in that typically 1 or 2 year period of a real estate recession?
Find another job. I'm trying to be funny, but I don't know, because the last time the market crashed like that was in 2008. I mean, sure, there's been like dips. I mean, you could say right now it's a dip. I don't know. I mean, it's not like, you know, it was in 2018 or in the midst of COVID, but we're in, you know, 2012 or 13 or 2004. Like, you know, we're not like in an all-time high market right now, but the only time I remember a shitty market was in 2008.
Yeah.
And at that point, I was only 4 years in the business. So I don't really, unfortunately, I can't really tell you, but have a backup plan.
When it comes to financing, I've always been surprised that the agents I've worked with have tend to stay away from financing. That's a big part of what I do, which is when a client is looking at a piece of property to buy, there's a lot of options out there that a lot of times the ultra high net worth clients don't know about. They can borrow against their portfolio. They can do a technical refi to pay all cash. They can get mortgages that are also tied to their portfolio.
Line of credit.
They can do lines of credit. They can do a 3-year mortgage, a 5-year mortgage, a 7-year mortgage, a 10-year mortgage. Is there a reason why it seems to me like agents stay away from that financing conversation? Or do you do it differently and you're working with either their financial advisor or their mortgage broker during that process?
Yeah, I don't think agents just have enough of background in finance. I don't think they know about that kind of stuff. I'm not a wizard either, but I know enough about like borrowing against your, I know the basics. I don't think most brokers do unless they have a lot of money and it's sitting in a private wealth, you know, and they have good brokers,
right?
Financial brokers, right?
Do you ever come across times where, especially for the bigger listings or the bigger buys, where there's all these intermediaries? For example, in business managers in Los Angeles.
Yeah,
is
the deal killers of the century.
Are they
the worst? I mean, they're the best because they refer business, but they're also the worst because they're trying to protect their clients. But sometimes they're not protecting their clients. In fact, they're either very conservative or they're trying to show off to their client how good they are, but they're also killing the fucking deal.
Yeah. Are there times where you've had to go directly to the client and be like, look, I know you've been with your business manager for a long time, but I'm your real estate agent?
Yeah, and then right in the beginning, the minute they talk about their business, I go, oh, fuck. I say, okay, look, you do you. You do whatever you want with your business manager, but I'm just telling you, from the beginning, your business manager is not a broker. No, actually, I say, where do they live? I ask them where their business manager lives. And when they tell me where they live, that tells me a lot about the person. So I'm not going to take advice on a home from a business manager who lives in Thousand Oaks about property value in Beverly Hills. Now, if he has a house on the 800 block of Alpine, I'm willing to listen to him.
Interesting. And have you, speaking of that whole world, which I think some of our audience is very familiar with, the business management community, but I moved out here in 2007 from New York City, and I wasn't really familiar And of course, there are business managers in New York City.
A lot.
But I wasn't too familiar with that whole business management
world.
More
of a Hollywood thing.
It's more of a Hollywood thing. And it's changed over the years. But do you actively keep a network of business managers that you include in marketing, dinners? Are you actively seeking referrals from business managers? Because it could seem like it could be a good...
Could be great.
Yeah.
And if I was better at prospecting or I was doing the things I did when I started the business, like door knocking and things like that, yeah, it would be great. At this point, I've gotten spoiled and I don't have time to do that. But like, you know, I'll have dinner parties at the house and I'll have Marty Singer, who's a major lawyer, and I'll have, or Patty Glazer, a major lawyer, then I'll have a huge business manager. I mean, I'll do it in a social aspect.
Right.
It won't be a business dinner. They're coming and they know when they're sitting at this dining room table, they're sitting with, you know, Candy Spelling or, you know, big people. And so they're like almost like thrilled that they're invited. So it's not a business dinner. And that's how I do business, because they see me as a prospect for them to get business without even having to say it. They just look around at who's sitting at the dining room table.
One thing I've always thought about real estate agents, which is interesting because our two jobs have a ton of similarity when it comes to what I think is the most important thing in both of our careers, which is behavioral psychology. And it's interesting to me that the way I get compensated is I have assets under management. Clients generally pay a percentage fee of those assets. And it's what's called an annuitized business, where as long as the client doesn't leave, they pay a quarterly fee and it's ongoing. One thing I've always had a lot of respect for with real estate agents is that you can do a deal with a client and it might be 5 or 7 years before you talk to that client again when they're looking to sell that house or buy a second home or do another transaction. So my question is there a specific strategy that you engage in, or how do you stay relevant for a client that buys a $20 million house through you?
It's hard because when they become your friend, then they're expecting after the deal is over that you continue to be their friend, or and then they might take offense that like the deal's done and you're not hanging out with them all the time. And then they maybe want to move on to something. And how in the world could I possibly hang out with 9,000 people? It's physically impossible. So you that's a tough one.
Staying relevant in their lives for the next transaction.
Well, maybe not staying relevant. Your name can be in front of their face, but it doesn't mean you're always interact. I mean, the best I can do is I'll invite them to charity dinners at the house, or like we're having 150 people here tomorrow for dinner. You know, it's not all people that I talk to all the time, but they're invited. So that's a nice thing to do.
I mean, that's a great strategy. That keeps people in the circle.
Or they're on my email blast list, things like that. But yeah, I'm sure there's a lot of people that haven't worked with me over the years that probably were, he sold my house for $10 million and I haven't heard from him in 3 years. Well, I'm sorry, I'm not your best friend. I'm your broker.
Right.
You know, there are times where I develop friendships and we actually stay and but I mean, it's impossible.
Right. Where does most of your new business come from? Aside from word of mouth.
It's all word of mouth.
It's all
Time somebody calls me, I always say, how did you find me? Nobody ever says, this person particularly, somebody called me today. I said, who referred you? He's like, your name is always passed around. I don't know, but I do ask always. It's very rarely that somebody says XYZ person. If XYZ person did refer me, I'll know ahead of time because XYZ person will have called me and said, I'm going to refer you to this person.
Wealthy people tend to buy a lot of real estate. So let's say you've got somebody that did a big transaction with you in Los Angeles, but they're looking for a place in Austin, Texas, or Miami, or overseas. What's the strategy there? Do you work with another broker and split a commission? Talk to us about how—
Take a referral fee.
Take a referral fee.
Yeah.
How do those work in your business?
25%. 20 to 25%.
Of the commission that the—
The other agent makes, 25% off the top.
So like if the agent were to make 2.5, you get 25% of the 2.5.
2.5 million?
No, the 2.5%.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then are you sort of in that process from like, you know, secondary or tertiary standpoint? Are you overseeing things? Obviously the client came to you and then you got to go find this other person, which does involve some risk. Right? Because you don't know exactly.
I'm only referring people. Generally, it's the only people I'm ever referring out are brokers either in the Hamptons, because I own a house there, or in Manhattan. it's where I'm like actually invested in because they've sold me properties or whatnot. Or like Miami, we have a property there or things like that. So Florida, Palm Beach, that stuff. But outside of Miami, Palm Beach, New York City, and Manhattan, if you called me and said, who's the best broker in San Francisco, I would have to figure it out. And mm-hmm. I wouldn't refer somebody unless it was, I knew it was a major buyer who was going to spend a lot of money there. And then I would find the right person to direct them to.
Is there a point in time where with the New York bi-coastal living situation that you would consider, I would assume you'd have to actually become a licensed agent in New York?
No, because I'm not selling houses there.
But if you were?
Oh, sure. I've thought about it, but then I'm thinking to myself, I'm not schlepping around and showing apartments in New York. I'm not interested.
But what about a $30 million listing?
Great idea, but honestly, it's ego-driven because if I can't be the biggest fish in the pond, I'm not interested.
Interesting.
I'm not going to start over. I'm going to start do my real estate exam now.
Are those state by state? Is that how that works?
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess somebody technically could have 50 brokerage licenses, 50 different states, technically.
You don't really see that, do you, right? People pretty much stick to their neighborhoods.
I know a few people that have licenses in New York, Texas, Florida, and California, but I've never heard of anything else than that.
Tell us what you're doing with the state media.
That's a pretty great business. We'll probably sell that in the next 18 months.
Tell us, for people who don't know, what that business is and how it got started.
It got started in my pool. Me and my buddy were just sitting in the pool and we were just like, we just came up with this concept. It's basically like, it's like TikTok for real estate. Anything real estate content-wise is what our media company does. We're the only one that I know of that does it. We don't have a competitor, which is why it's so valuable.
And tell us, how does estate media actually work? How are revenues generated? What is the business aspect of estate media?
That would be something my CFO would have to explain to you. That goes beyond my scope, but I don't think I can answer that without sounding really stupid.
Okay.
Because I'm not a techie person. I just knew the concept and I left everything for him to do with. But I know we built up a huge business because I see the numbers.
And then when you talk about a sale, what's the decision-making there? Why would you not keep running with it and build it to an even greater number, or?
The sale of estate media?
Yes.
Well, because we could just sell it and do it again.
And come up with a different name for it.
People do that all the time.
Josh, do you have a particular story that you can recall where you had a deal that you'd put a lot of time and effort into, and the deal fell apart?
Yes.
And then let's say it resurfaced, or there was actually a positive outcome from that. One of the things I like to address in this podcast is some of the most difficult times that successful people have had to endure, and they stuck to their guns and came out from it with a positive experience on the other side.
I mean, there's a house I just sold for a client, and I represented the buyer and the seller. And we had two buyers to choose from. One of them I knew that would give me the listing on their house to sell, also the buyer. And both offers were it was literally like flip a coin, which one do you want? I literally said transparently to the seller, I said, you're going to be fine with either of the one. Me personally, I'd rather take this guy because he wants me to sell his house afterwards, but that doesn't affect you. It only affects me. You pick. And so we picked. But I was representing the buyers on both sides. So I represented the seller. I represented one of the buyers. I also represented one of the other buyers. One of those buyers had a house for me to sell later. So we were like, okay, let's go with the one that Josh can sell his house with later. Who cares? They closed on the transaction. And then he sold his house off markets in a deal directly. So I didn't get to sell his other house. But that deal then fell apart. And then they hired me today to sell it. So I guess
it still came back around.
Yeah, it came back around.
Yeah. I've always been curious about this. When an agent is representing the seller and the buyer,
mm-hmm.
and it seems for someone like me who's not in the business that there's a potential conflict of interest there.
Sure, but you're also a mind reader too. Think about it. You can put a deal together because you're representing both sides. I think that that's a good thing because mm-hmm. you know how to put a deal together. You're not dealing with two different people.
Is there room for
it's like asking a shrink, like, is it ethically okay to see a husband and wife separately and together?
Right.
If you're you can fix a marriage if you're a great shrink and you can do that. You could argue that one could say that's unethical and one could say if you're shrewd and good and you can, and you're listening to both people, you know how to fix something, fix it.
And like you said before, it's definitely circumstantial.
Yeah, it's circumstantial. I can see how it could be a, definitely could be a conflict of interest. It just depends on the broker, depends on the buyer, depends on the seller. There's a lot of factors.
Do you have people come to you and say, oh, well, you're representing the seller and the buyer. That's going to be 5 or 6%. Can you come down on
that? Yeah, they do that all the time. I just had this the other day. It was really silly. I reduced my commission from 5 to 3.5%, which I never do. I always represent, if I represent both sides of the deal, I'll bring it down to 4%. But I represented the buyer and the seller, and I brought it down to 3.5% because the seller was, this is like 2 years ago, I brought the tenant in and we negotiated 3.5% if the tenant bought the house. So I gave him a killer deal, 3.5%. Then the other day he calls me, he goes, okay, great, the tenant's buying. Is buying the house. I go, fantastic. We'll draft up the paperwork, whatever. And then like a week later, he goes, so I become really close friends with the tenant. He's my buddy. We go out to dinner all the time. I really want to do a nice thing for him. You know, the roof needs some work. I want to give him a credit of $25,000. I go, that's great. I'll give him 25%, whatever. He goes, no, but I want you to pay it. I go, why would I do that? He goes, well, because you're making $250,000. I go, yeah, what's your point? He goes, well, that's a lot of money. I go, well, I was supposed to make 375. I brought it down to 250. Why are we going beyond this? Why am I taking 225? That's a lot of money. I go, he's not my buddy. You don't have to give this guy a credit. You've decided to do that. Be my guest. I don't care what you do, but you got me down from 5 to 3.5. Now you want me to go down to 3.25.
What's next?
Not even what's next. Like, why?
You need a car wash?
And I kept saying over and over again, justify to me, tell me why. He goes, Josh, I want to leave with a good feeling. I want us to have a good relationship. We've sold many houses together. I go, and I've also made you millions of dollars in real estate. Tell me why. And he just kept saying, Josh, it's a lot of money. Just do it. Just do it. I'm like, no, I absolutely will not do it. And
that was smart. I think there would have been another request after that.
Probably not, but there was no reason. If you can give me a valid reason, or if it's a full 5% commission and there's something to bridge the gap, I'm not a pig. I'll figure it out.
Right.
But like, there was no validity as to why I should take care of that. Then it got to the point where I was like, honestly, I was like, fuck this guy. This guy's really pissing me off. So I said, you know what? I'm not going to give you anything, but what I'll do is you name any charity you want. I'll give $10,000 in your
name. That's nice. How'd they respond to that?
I don't need your charity money.
Whoa. Wow.
So I guess we're not working together anymore.
It reminds me of the story you told in the book about the woman who looked at a million things with you. And then I think it was, she wanted you to buy her a computer.
Oh yeah. That lady. That's an example of maybe where I should have bought her the computer, because she'd end up selling her house.
That's what you said in the
book. Yeah. But how often does that happen? That was just weird.
That's also, I think, you know, when we talk about these red flags, yes, sometimes you're going to have a little bit of regret because you didn't do something, but the 99 times out of 100.
I'll take the one time that excites me in the ass. It's fine.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's having those rules set up in advance.
All the time these brokers are like, oh my God, how do you always get full commissions? I'm like, how do you not? I tell them up front. I just don't cave. A lot of these brokers cave, and they just like, or they'll come in immediately on the listing if they know they're going against other people, and they'll say, well, we'll do it for less money. I'm like, you don't need to do that. Wait till the seller asks you for a lower commission and then you can think about it. But like,
why lead with that?
I don't know. They obviously didn't read my book.
Good point, which they should. It's interesting. I've been hearing these commercials on, I think it's like CNBC in my car. And these commercials will be like, this company will pay you for your listing, which I'm assuming is they're not really paying you. They're giving you some sort of discount to—
You mean they'll buy your house is what you mean?
No, it's this thing where it's like, if you list with us, we will pay you to list with us. That's literally what they say, which to me is like, you know.
Will that mean, well,
it's a weird legality.
You mean they'll front
there.
You the money? Is that what you mean?
I don't know. I was wondering, front the money, how does that work?
Maybe if an agent doesn't have any money, and we're talking about usually like smaller agents and like small deals.
Yeah.
You can say the commission's 2.5%, say they need to make their car payment or something. Some companies will front them, you know, like 1%, and then they'll keep the other 1.5%.
And this is on smaller deals.
I'm just talking about things I've heard on the radio. I've never done it.
$5,000 condo or
something. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. So as we wrap up here, Josh, one thing I like to talk to people about that have been in business for a long time is, how would you do things differently if you could counsel you could have a time machine and you could go back in time and talk to your 18-year-old self, what advice would you give to your 18-year-old self, knowing all that you know now about real estate, behavioral psychology, doing deals? What advice would you give to yourself specifically to fast track your growth in business? Whereas, I mean, you were a superstar coming on the scene very hot in the beginning, but what advice would you give yourself if you could go back in time?
I would have not come on so hot. I was very arrogant and I broke a lot of bridges with other brokers. And it took a long time to repair those bridges. I was like 18 and I was cocky as could be and I pissed off a lot of brokers. I fixed it. It took some time. Maybe I didn't fail. I don't know. Maybe there's some brokers that still don't like me. I don't know. But that would be the only thing I would have done differently.
And nothing from a marketing standpoint or the identification of some of these red flags we talked about. You just have to learn that, I think, in time, right? That stuff only comes from experience and being part of those deals. Was there a time where you started this business so young, 18 years old? Was there a time where you got one of your first big deals and that commission check came in and you said, whoa, now it's real?
Yeah. I think when I bought one of my first major pieces of art.
Which was what?
It's around the corner here. It's a Calder.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I was like, okay, whoa.
And then I think the funny thing that people that are in sales realize is that you have that self-satisfaction and then you wake up tomorrow and it's like, oh, got to do it all over again.
Yeah. That's fun. I like doing it every day.
You still enjoy it?
I love it.
Do you ever see, I mean, you're still so young. Do you ever see a time where you'd be retired, or is this like, no, you do this until you die? Yeah.
No, be bored.
You're very much known for creating what I call a pyramid, top down, right? You're the agent. The client gets your time. People spend time with you. You're at the property. Do you think that could ever change? I see a lot of agents where they've got these big teams.
I'm not interested in that. I don't want a team.
I think there's a lot of wisdom in there. And can you talk for the audience about how you've come to that decision where it's, you know what, this is a lone wolf business as far as you run it. But have there been times or have there been circumstances where you were tempted to bring in junior agents or you did, and it was not a successful endeavor? And so you said, I'm not going to do that. Or have you just—
Anytime I've had a little junior agent working for me, it's been more time than an energy, you know. It's never been worth it to me. And I don't want to operate a huge team. I'm not interested.
Yeah, you go from being an agent to a HR manager real quick.
Not interested.
Excellent. Where do you guys like to go in Los Angeles?
Tonight we're going to Bird Suits Club.
Oh, very nice. I haven't been up there. How is it?
It's good. You'll like it. It's really, you should go. It's really good. It's a members club on Sunset. They opened, I think it's a better version of Soho House.
Oh, so it's a members club.
Yeah.
And for you to apply for a membership in different parts of LA, what's been one that you've coveted and either gotten into or had a hard time getting into?
Well, in LA, I'm members of there and the tennis club. Not that I play tennis, but it's a great lunch. Members there, my parents are at Brentwood, so we go there a lot. And then in New York, I just joined Coco's, which is really cool.
Well, Josh, I can't thank you enough for your time today. It's
my
been
pleasure.
Great sitting down with you, and we'll talk soon.
Bye-bye.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review Client Relationship Summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.
This podcast was edited by Resonate Recordings.